welcome to the Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi, a journalist and political analyst and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington. In this episode, we'll talk about the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, the regional implications of this conflict, U.S. policy towards the region, and also the role of Iran and its proxies. My guests today are Matt Duss, the Executive Vice President at Center for International Policy, and Sino Tusi, a Senior Fellow also at Center for International Policy. Matt and Sino, welcome back to the Iran Podcast.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Matt, let's start with October 7th, the Hamas attack or breach of the southern border in Israel. How did that happen, essentially the surprise element in this historic, in a way, breach and the ensuing violence and carnage that took place with many casualties, civilians in the southern border of Israel? Talk about the domestic and regional factors that essentially led to such a successful operation.
Sure. Well, I mean, how it happened, I mean, that's a question that a lot of people are asking. That's a question that there will almost certainly be a pretty major investigation into in Israel. And frankly, that's, I think, an investigation that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not looking forward to, given that this is one of the most serious security failures and intelligence failures in Israel's history. As you noted, some, you know, over, it seems, over 2,000 Hamas fighters were able to breach the Gaza fence line. And I think it's worth noting it's not a border. It's you know, a fence line because Israel still does militarily occupy Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. These are all still occupied territories, even though Gaza has been under essentially a blockade and since the withdrawal of Israeli settlements back in 2005. But still, this fence line, you know, there is a large fence. There's all kinds of cameras monitoring the area. And there's usually a large number of troops. But in this case, as some of the information that's come out, that a lot of troops, and this is from Israeli sources, had been redeployed from the Gaza fence line to the West Bank to defend settlers who have been carrying out a series of increasingly aggressive attacks against Palestinian civilians as part of their project of expanding settlements and trying to move Palestinians off their land so they can take control of it. But still, the failure here, I mean, when you understand the number of Hamas fighters involved, the various means through which they breached the fence line, including the use of hang gliders, using tractors to knock down the fence and then moving through on motorcycles and on foot and other means of transportation. The amount of planning that clearly went into this, the number of people who knew about it, and the failure of the Israeli intelligence services to really pick up like something like this or know it was going to happen, even though, you know, there has been some reporting that's come out that said there were people who were sounding some alarms over the past year or more, just that it looked like there was training ongoing for some kind of new operation that they weren't sure what it was. So in retrospect, that stuff, of course, becomes much clearer. But, you know, the failure here is, you know, a lot of people have compared it to the 1973 Yom Kippur War, which the 50th anniversary of which was very, very close to October 7th. And the psychological impact on Israelis has been enormous. I mean, not just because of the graphic violence and rape and really horrible acts of terrorism that were carried out by Hamas, but just because it really struck and was intended to strike at Israelis' basic sense of security. This has been Benjamin Netanyahu's main political argument to the people of Israel for his entire political career, which is that I am the one who keeps you safe. You may not like how I do it, but with me in power, you can be confident that, you know, your children will be safe. You will be safe in your homes. And that is, you know, that was among the kind of illusions that have been discredited on October 7th. That was a main one. And so he knows that once this war stops and once he has to face a real accountability, that his political career is pretty much over.
Mm-hmm. Matt, I want to get back to that later, but let me bring in Sina and again, go back to October 7th. Sina, we know Hamas is an ally of Iran, essentially one of its proxies in the region, and that Iran has supported them militarily, politically, financially. But at the same time, in the first week after the attack, there were talks or certain comments that Iran was behind the planning. And then eventually we saw U.S. intelligence suggesting or indicating that the Iranian leaders were actually surprised by the Hamas attack to some extent. And then we saw sort of a campaign of public diplomacy launched by Tehran, essentially trying to say that this was an independent Palestinian operation. Talk about that. And how much you think the Iranians were or not behind this, supportive of this, or benefited from the October 7th attack?
Yeah, so as you said, Negar, that, you know, there's no doubt that Iran is a major patron of Hamas. It provides it both political, militarily, and financial support. But with this attack, you know, Iran has maintained a policy of strategic ambiguity, I would say, that in this context of this kind of covert war, this cold war that has been going on between Iran and Israel for many years now, that has seen, you know, Israel launch attacks inside Iran, you know, sabotage nuclear facilities, assassinate scientists, that Iran has supported these various allies in the group, Hezbollah, Hamas, various armed groups in Syria to attack Israel. And with this attack, though, Iran was quick to deny involvement. And as you said, it says that these groups operate independently, that it doesn't exercise direct control over them. But Iranian officials have very much been very triumphalist in their rhetoric, saying that Israel, you know, that these Israeli policies have kind of backfired, that this was a major victory for Hamas and what they call the resistance axis, which is their network of alliances in the region. And we have seen that while Iranian officials are saying they want to avoid a major regional war, they don't want this to spread, that it does seem that they have green-lighted or at least not work to prevent these series of, you know, attacks against Israel and U.S. positions in the region by Iranian allies. We've seen that Hezbollah and Israel have had pretty strong, severe skirmishes on the northern border of Israel. We've seen that in Iraq, various armed groups that are close to Iran have been launching rocket attacks on U.S. military bases. And the Houthis, most notably, have been launching missiles from Yemen to target southern Israel. And most recently, they captured a cargo ship that they said was Israeli, but it's not. It's partly owned by an Israeli billionaire, is my understanding. But, the Houthis stand to kind of obstruct Israeli shipping in the Red Sea, which is a very strategic kind of shipping lane for the global economy, really. So that there's all these various regional flashpoints. It really is a very volatile situation. It's unclear what the red lines of Iran and its allies are. Initially, there were some of the rhetoric suggested that maybe a ground invasion would be a potential red line where Iran and its allies would get more involved, but that did not happen. And some people now, there's some rhetoric that suggests the elimination of Hamas, that some of the analyses that I read in the Iranian press, that the elimination, if Hamas is really on the cusp of being kind of really removed from Gaza, that could result in increased Iranian action. But right now, the rhetoric in Iran is actually surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, but is very much of restraint, is very much kind of echoing even what the U.S. says, that, you know, they don't want an expanded war. America doesn't want an expanded war. But I think the real risk is kind of miscalculation by any of these parties involved and crossing a kind of red line and where this conflict can really expand.
Mm-hmm. And Sina, you also had a great piece on this in Foreign Policy Magazine titled How Iran Really Sees the Israel-Hamas War, in which you explain these points in more detail. And you also talk about the Iranian civil society, which I want to get to later. But let me go back to Matt and talk about U.S. policy. Western policy in general, but specifically US and to some extent EU, its main European allies, towards the region in general, but also in this conflict in particular, starting with the president himself, top national security officials, and just the entirety of the United States policy towards the conflict. What is your assessment? I know you've been publicly and privately critical of the U.S. policy. Talk about that and why your criticism.
Yeah, I mean, the Biden administration's policy toward the Middle East, you know, has been, first of all, I mean, Biden has historically been extremely pro-Israel. He's representative of a kind of portion of the democratic establishment in that way. But particularly, his approach is characterized by the term no daylight. He's someone who just really believes that there shouldn't be any daylight or any space publicly between the U.S. and Israel, and that if, you know, there are differences in approach that there are criticisms to be made, that those criticisms should be made privately, and there's going to be very little pressure brought to bear on Israeli policy or Israeli behavior. And we see how that's playing out right now. I mean, there are certainly things that, you know, the Biden administration is willing to push the Israelis on or to change slightly. But in the larger picture, I mean, you have now over 12,000 people killed, some 40% of them children. Israel has not really, you know, explained how it intends to carry out its goal of, you know, quote unquote, ending Hamas. But this administration still does not seem inclined, and the president doesn't seem inclined to hold them back in any real way. As far as the approach to the region, I mean, they've been very, I mean, one way to understand their approach to the region is that everything is seen through the lens of strategic competition with China. And I think this is what really underlies the approach, which is, you know, the administration came into office and they took a position on the Abraham Accords, which is the, you know, the agreement that the Trump administration helped broker between United Arab Emirates and Israel, and then later Bahrain and some others. Trump promoted this as kind of a huge regional peace deal, which is not really true. I mean, Israel was not at war with these countries, but it did normalize relations. It set up a huge, you know, a set of arms deals from the U.S. to these countries. And that's what essentially the Abraham Accords are. It's, you know, the U.S. agreeing to sell arms and provide security for some of these, you know, authoritarian governments in exchange for them normalizing relationships with Israel. And obviously Israel gains a lot from those normalization agreements too. And, you know, stopping for a moment to say that, you know, Israel's genuine normalization in the region, I think is very positive. Israel's a part of this region. It will continue to be a part of this region. Unfortunately, the Abraham Accords, the logic, you know, undergirding the Abraham Accords is essentially one of supporting authoritarianism, supporting repression, supporting governments who, you know, do not represent the will of their people, are not accountable to their people, or in the case of Israel, you know, rule over millions of Palestinians who do not get to vote for the government that rules them. You know, the Biden administration took office initially kind of like holding the Abraham Accords at arm's length. But, you know, after a few months, they really shifted and have embraced them fully and see this as a kind of basis for their entire regional policy. Because, again, the kind of overriding imperative of their policy in the region and around the world is, you know, strategic competition with China. And they see this as a way of kind of sustaining American hegemony in the Middle East and a way of boxing China out from creating greater inroads or building stronger relationships in the Middle East. And, you know, the last point I'll make on this is that part of that, you know, as part of, you know, consigning populations in the Middle East to a future of repression, the Palestinians were foremost among those populations who would be kind of just pushed to the side, and they don't get any real consideration. They might get a bit more funding here and there, and there might be a few steps taken to make their lives, you know, their oppression slightly less awful. But, you know, no real vision of human rights or democracy, despite the president's high flown rhetoric on all of these things. And, you know, and I think the October 7th attack and the ensuing war really showed, demonstrated that this is a failed security concept. And that was the piece I wrote for Foreign Affairs about a week after the, or a couple of weeks after the attack, was, you know, the administration's approach to the region was based on all of what I just said. And they were, you know, they intended to kind of invest in repression and in order to get peace and stability for the United States, and they have not gotten that. They've now had to extend enormous time and resources dealing with a region that the president had hoped not to have to bother with very much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was looking. You've had a few good pieces in the past few weeks, but the one in Foreign Policy magazine called "The End of Biden's Middle East Mirage," in which you explain that the Biden administration's regional security concept has collapsed. And I see you asking, does the president even know it? I encourage everyone to read that piece in addition to Sina's piece. But Sina, let me get back to you and talk a little bit about the field, especially the Northern Front. We know another Iran ally, a closer ally, much closer ally, Hezbollah, is also engaged in the Northern Front with Israel, has been since the beginning of the conflict, with missiles, artillery, and drones back and forth with Israeli forces. But at the same time, and this is something we saw echoed not only in Iranian officials' statements, but also in that much anticipated speech by Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, that it seems like so far the policy, as you explained about Iran and by extension Hezbollah, is to not escalate this out of hand into an all-out war or a major regional conflict. And the activities of Hezbollah in the Northern Front seem to be aligned with that. I saw that the Israeli military intelligence, this was in the Haaretz today, that Israeli intelligence had warned Netanyahu that Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas are seeing an opportunity for a perfect storm. They've essentially been warning the Israeli side to not escalate. How do you see Hezbollah's role, Sina, and the other proxies, but specifically Hezbollah, and their engagement so far with Israel in the past month and a half?
Yeah, Hezbollah's attacks, I think, are meant to signal a number of things. Hezbollah and, you know, the Iranian actions together, they are making credible threats against the U.S. and Israel if this war were to be expanded. So whether we look at Hezbollah's attacks inside Israel or the Iraqi armed groups attacking U.S. military bases, that it is, you know, in one way, a major signal of deterrence, that if this war were to expand, that it would be region-wide, that these groups that, you know, when it comes to Hezbollah, are far more capable than Hamas. Hezbollah has, you know, well over 100,000 rockets, it is estimated. Many of them are sophisticated, precision-guided. They're much more of a military-capable force, battle-hardened in the Syrian war. And so they are, again, engaging in these low-level attacks we are seeing right now, but again, with this risk of very dangerous escalation, where in Israel, their government has also been divided on how to engage Hezbollah right now. From my understanding, the defense minister is actually more hawkish on Hezbollah and also, you know, is pushing for kind of a bigger attack on Hezbollah, whereas Netanyahu, I believe, wants to focus on Hamas for now. But, and we saw this major kind of back and forth recently where Israel launched some major airstrikes inside Lebanon and Hezbollah retaliated and attacked the barracks, I believe. But these attacks are also, in addition to signaling deterrence, being a credible threat, they are diverting Israel's attention and resources away, you know, from Gaza. And to the extent that they do that, I think, you know, Iran and them views that as a benefit, same with the Houthis. And I think the overall context for Iran is also that the Islamic Republic, you know, in these years of covert war that they've had with Israel, they are kind of presenting themselves as taking the war into Israel. And amongst this competition between Islamic countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, for kind of leadership of the Islamic world or moral leadership of the Islamic world, that Iran is also vying for that and is trying to be seen as the most credible Islamic power that is kind of taking to the fight to Israel. So these are all, I think, factors that are influencing all of this. But for now, I mean, Iranian leaders are very much emphasizing that they don't want the war to to expand, and they're kind of trying to shame other Islamic countries as well by trying to portray themselves as engaging in these actions. And like Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader this week, said that he called on Islamic countries to do a economic boycott of Israel. And he also said something like those countries that have political ties for Israel, they should end them at least temporarily. Like he was trying to shame them and say, you can't even like end ties with Israel temporarily. So that's kind of, I think, at least from the official perspective, how Iran is approaching this.
Mm-hmm. Matt, let's talk about the strategy and the end goal here for Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu, we hear statements from his cabinet in the Knesset, also a lot of criticism from the Israeli civil society inside the country, even hostage families. What is the plan both for Gaza and also we see this extending into the West Bank? What do you think is Netanyahu and his government's plan for the future, not just enclave, not just Gaza, but for the question of Palestine in general?
Well, it's clear what their plan is. I mean, the founding agreement of this governing coalition asserts unequivocally that the Jews and Jews alone have full rights in the land of Israel, and that means all of the land of Israel and Palestine. Exclusive rights, and they use that word exclusive, that the Jewish people alone have claim to this land. And, you know, they are actively trying to, and you know, successfully implementing that claim, expanding settlements very aggressively in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, you know, harassing and essentially, you know, doing a slow motion version. I mean, ethnic cleansing is a term that is often used, and that often implies a very violent kind of driving people out of their land, which of course sometimes happens by settlers, but a more slow motion version, which is like essentially to make, you know, Palestinian life extremely uncomfortable, inconvenient, and impossible in certain areas to you know, essentially force Palestinian communities to leave and to kind of assemble in population centers that are governed, you know, ostensibly governed or controlled by the Palestinian Authority. And it's created what is a lot of people have referred to as a series of Palestinian Bantustans, which is a term that comes from the apartheid era in South Africa, where there was a series of homelands created for Black South Africans where they could, you know, quote unquote, rule themselves. Of course, they did not have real sovereignty. These were essentially just reservations where they could be contained so as not to bother the real control, you know, the people who really had the power, who were the white South Africans. And here you've got the Israeli government that is actively trying, you know, that is trying to entrench permanent control over these occupied territories. Now, for Gaza, we already see a number of Israeli ministers and other voices calling to, you know, fully, you know, reoccupy and return settlements to Gaza. We see a forced migration of Palestinians from the north part of Gaza to the southern part of Gaza as the Israeli military pummels Gaza City, which is now basically a ruin. Gaza City was the biggest Palestinian city. It is now just uninhabitable. You've had millions, I think 1.5 million out of the 2.3 million residents of Gaza who have fled. That's a huge number of people. That's a huge number of internal refugees. But the key question is, what is Israel's plan? And that is part of what is so frightening here, is that Israel doesn't really seem to have a plan beyond just, quote unquote, ending Hamas. Now, you will not end Hamas. You may kill a lot of Hamas commanders. You will, you know, diminish Hamas's ability to carry out attacks. But in terms of just ending Hamas as an organization, that is extremely difficult, if not impossible. The United States found this out in its various efforts over the war on terror over the past 20 some years. You know, you can weaken and diminish some of these movements, but you cannot completely erase them. And, you know, nevertheless, Israel continues to carry out this massive military operation with huge numbers of civilian casualties and deaths and displacement. And the United States, the Biden administration, is, while kind of pressing them on, you know, change in tactics here and there, is more or less just letting them do it.
Mm-hmm. Sina, let's move inside Iran. In your piece, you talked about the statements of the various Iranian officials, the political factions, but you also talk about the civil society. Tell us how this has, first of all, impacted this war, any impacts on Iran's domestic politics, and also what you're seeing or the contrast between the official statements and how the civil society specifically has responded to the conflict.
Yeah, to really break down how, you know, Iran and Iranians view this war, view the Palestinian issue, I think, you know, the historical context and Iran's role in this crisis is very important. I mean, we've seen that, you know, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the coming to power of this kind of Shia revolutionary theocracy, that this, you know, Islamic Republic was from the get-go isolated in the region, was a revisionist power, going against the kind of the regional security order as it had existed. And, you know, this is a minority, you know, Shias are minorities in the Muslim world, and Persians and Iranians are minorities in the large, you know, largely Arab Middle East. So what the Palestinian has allowed the Iranian government to do, and one reason that they do aggressively support the Palestinians or try to portray themselves as doing that, is to compensate for their isolation as a kind of Persian Shia state in this predominantly Sunni Arab region, and elevate their status within the kind of Islamic world as this revolutionary power that would have legitimacy amongst a lot of Muslims. But within Iran, you know, many Iranians, after decades of the Islamic Republic's severe repression and kind of hypocrisies on various issues, you know, are wholly disenchanted and opposed to Iran, the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, and view it as having been very costly for the country. And within this context, we now see that in this current war, that some Iranian opposition groups, especially those in the Iranian diaspora abroad, they have been more overtly and very heavily advocating for Israel, blaming Hamas and the Palestinians for this crisis, and blaming Iran and the Islamic Republic. But, you know, I think we have to also distinguish between various aspects of, you know, the Iranian opposition and those within the country, those outside of the country. There have also been many Iranian opposition groups and figures, especially within the country, people who are in prison, people who have long track records of pushing for human rights in Iran, who have been criticizing actually both, you know, the Hamas attack very vociferously and also Israel's assault on Gaza, and calling for a ceasefire and kind of joining this very kind of widespread global call for a ceasefire and addressing the root cause of this crisis in a just way. So this includes people like Narges Mohammadi, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, who's an Iranian women's rights activist and who's currently imprisoned in Evin prison, the notorious prison in Tehran. And she issued a statement calling for a ceasefire. Her husband, Taghi Rahmani, who's also a prominent activist in his own right and is based in France, he released a statement along with, I think it was dozens of Iranian human rights activists and civil society activists, also condemning the Hamas attack, calling for a ceasefire, criticizing Israel, criticizing the Islamic Republic for its role in perpetuating this conflict, and calling for a kind of just solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we've seen many other kind of activists, a labor union, actually, it was a couple of days ago that this prominent Iranian labor activist, Hassan Saidi, who's imprisoned in Evin prison as well, he wrote a letter where he echoed all of these things I just said, condemning the Israeli occupation, condemning Hamas, condemning Israel's assault on Gaza, and calling for an independent Palestinian state is actually what he wrote in his letter. And he also said that his labor union, which is a prominent labor union and bus workers in Iran, like public transportation workers. And so this is, you know, it's not a black and white picture. Iran is obviously not a monolithic society, but a lot of the most organic grassroots activists in Iran have this very nuanced position where they support Palestinian rights. They want a kind of just solution to this crisis, while they're also very critical of Iran's role and the Islamic Republic's role in this crisis. And that is kind of differentiated with a lot of the diaspora opposition who are, you know, so many of these people are also very close to kind of pro right wing pro-Israel groups. And they are more very overtly in favor of Israel in this war.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Matt, I want to talk to you about the double standards or the hypocrisy that we're seeing and we hear being called out by many activists, civil society actors within the region, but in the larger global South, as I want to call it. It's a tough generalization, the global South versus the global North or the West. As we know, also there's Ireland, which takes a very different stance, let's say, compared to, for example, Germany. But if we want, in the interest of simplifying, talk about this double standard, specifically from your viewpoint in Washington towards U.S. policy and its Western allies, and the impacts, the global impacts of this war and this double standard that the West is implying to a conflict where an ally, a close ally, is involved as opposed to other conflict where it would be foes.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is a huge problem, I think, because we've just, you know, as listeners know, in February of 2022, the Russian military launched a major invasion of Ukraine. It had already occupied eastern parts of Ukraine. But in February 2022, it launched a major invasion into the rest of Ukraine. And as part of that, the United States and European allies, you know, strongly supported Russia or Ukraine's defense, have continued to do that, and have pointed out and condemned Russia for violating the laws of war. They made reference to different Russian tactics, such as, you know, cutting off electricity and water to civilian populations as terrorism. And, you know, I my own view, and I know that, you know, people can have their own views, of course, my own view is that the Biden administration's approach to Ukraine has been important and admirable. It's something I support. I think there are important principles of international law that are pretty foundational at play in Ukraine, the right of people to defend themselves, the right of countries not to be invaded, and laws regarding the treatment of civilians that Russia has egregiously violated. So, you know, I thought it was important for the U.S. and its allies to kind of support those principles, and they have really done so. Unfortunately, as we've seen with Israel's response to the attacks of October 7, a lot of these same tactics, like such as collective punishment of civilians, cutting off water and electricity, which Israel has done to populations in the Gaza Strip, as a tactic of pressure against Hamas, all of a sudden there's very little condemnation. In fact, you see Western leaders going to Israel to stand in solidarity with Israel. Now, I don't want to treat these two situations as completely similar or completely different. I would say there are principles. You know, Russia has been occupying Ukraine. Israel occupies Palestine. This is not a war in Gaza. It's not a war between two states. This is a war that Israel is waging against a terrorist group which carried out a horrible, egregious atrocity against its civilians. It is quite true, and we have to keep recognizing that. However, it is making war essentially on Gaza civilians as part of that response. And, you know, as I said earlier, the Biden administration has never been inclined and has not shown any inclination to put any real pressure on Israel about the conduct, its conduct of the war. I mean, it will make criticisms here and there. For example, just today, some news was coming out how, you know, the U.S. is pushing Israel hard not to bomb hospitals. Which, okay, great. I'm glad you're doing that. I mean, I wish you had been doing this a month and change ago. And by the way, why in the world would, you know, why in the world is Israel bombing hospitals in the first place, such that we have to, you know, the United States needs to expend energy to get them to stop? So going to the issue, your question of double standard, I think the U.S. has been trying very hard over the past 2 years to garner support amongst countries in the global South. And I understand that that term is not used by all, but, you know, trying to explain why supporting Ukraine's self-defense is important for you know, countries in the global South to get on board with. And I think that argument is pretty much over now, that the United States has shown that in certain cases, when it comes to the U.S.'s partners and the U.S.'s favored countries, that those principles and those standards just go right out the window. So I think this has been a really frustrating time for those of us who really do want to see a genuinely rules-based order built in the world where, you know, allies and adversaries are held to the same standards rather than double standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time. And on that note, I want to thank you both for joining or coming back on the Iran podcast, Matt and Sina.
Very glad to. Thank you, Nigar.
Yes, thanks a lot, Nigar.
That was Matthew Duss, the Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy, and Sina Tusi, a Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy here in Washington. And thank you for listening to the Iran podcast. You can find us on all major podcast apps, so do subscribe. And if you can, leave a review and rating for us. You can also follow us on Twitter or X at Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi, and until next time, goodbye.